This program is released under a Creative Commons license. For more information, visit creativecommons.org. This is Christ the Center, episode 37. Join us today as we speak with Ron Gleason about Herman Bavinck. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, a weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I have with me this afternoon Lane Keister, who is pastor at Hull Christian Reformed Church and Hope Reformed Church in Hague, North Dakota. Jeff Waddington, who is teacher of the congregation at Calvary OPC in Ringgoes, New Jersey. And Ron Gleason, who is the pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church in Yorba Linda, California. He's also the co-editor of a recent volume, Reforming or Conforming, which we've spoken about before, and also working on a biography of Herman Bavinck, whom we will speak about today. Good afternoon, guys. It's a pleasure to have you with me.
Good afternoon.
It's an honor to be on your podcast.
Excellent. Well, thank you. We are very interested to speak about Herman Bavinck. There's been renewed interest in him since his works have now been translated into English. A very excellent series that has been produced. And we are excited to talk about him today, as well as a little bit about Reforming and Conforming. But first, Jeff, we have a load of new books that have come out. It seemed like we had a little drought for a few weeks, but there has been several new books released just in the last week. What are some of those?
Well, one that I'm excited about is one that's actually not out yet, and that is the final volume of the works of Jonathan Edwards, Yale edition, volume 26, The Catalogs of Books.
And I read your post today on that.
Yeah, I got my review copy a couple of days ago, and it's a beauty. It's, like I said, it's the last volume. Any additional material will go on the website at the Jonathan Edwards Center at Yale. Will not, and of course, the Jonathan Edwards Center will work with scholars who want to take other material that has not made it into the works and publish it as a standalone volume. So That's already happened. There are several standalone volumes of Edwards' sermons, for instance, that have the imprimatur of the Jonathan Edwards Center, but are not published as part of the works. Mm-hmm. So that I'll be saying more about that in the weeks ahead as I get to that book on, you know, along with all of the other books I have to review. Go ahead.
Now, you were saying, you mentioned, but how many volumes does that make, that set?
That is, well, it's number 26, but volume 24, which was the blank Bible, was actually two huge volumes, and it was 24 A and B. So there's actually 27 books in the set. And that will be, the final volume will be available, I believe, on the 5th of October or something like that, about the time of Edwards' birthday.
Hmm. What does that come out to be, about 10 yards of bookshelf space?
I'm looking at my shelf right now. Not quite.
Okay.
More like three shelves, three-foot-long shelves.
There you go.
So nine feet.
Well, I have the complete Edwards, too, but it's only, I don't know, 4 feet of shelf space, I would say, on mine. But
yeah, in this
yeah,
case,
I've got big shelves.
The interesting part is not the length of the footage, but the cost in the pocketbook.
Yes, really? Each one runs about $100 when you don't get a review copy, when we're not all blessed like our friend Jeff here.
Hey, and this is the only one of the volumes that I've gotten as a review copy, in all fairness, okay?
Take it easy.
So, that's one book. And then in terms of, I don't know that there's, in terms of already out new books, there's a new book by Stephen Nichols, I see.
Yeah, I noticed that, called Getting the Blues, What Blues Music Teaches Us About Suffering and Salvation.
Yeah, it looks like it could be an interesting book in terms of cultural apologetics or cultural understanding, right?
Right, and that might have some overlapping themes with his, well, maybe not, with Jesus Made in America, but it
Well, this book is more, I think, and he could correct us maybe if we have him on the show in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me this is more getting into his own personal taste in music.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be an interesting book to look over. But there are some forthcoming titles that are worth considering, looking at. One would be The Pastor's Public Ministry. By Terry Johnson, who is, I believe, the pastor of Independent Presbyterian Church in Savannah, Georgia.
That's right.
Almost anything by him on worship or on anything is going to be worth reading. Then there is, I believe, Richard Baucom's book, Jesus and the God of Israel, which I think is an expanded edition of a book that used to be called God Crucified. Then there's, I think we've already talked about this volume, but Living for God's Glory, which is a volume edited by Joel Beakey. And then there's The Everyday Work of the Westminster Assembly. I think that's a book that was written in the 1800s that's now coming back into print. Then you have, let's see, we've already mentioned this, but this month we're supposed to get the Saved by Grace volume, right? The Holy Spirit's Work in Calling and Regeneration by Herman Bavinck. I want to say that, you know, for my mates down in Australia.
That's a very interesting volume because it was part of a polemic, really, between Kuyper and Bavinck.
Huh.
Oh, interesting.
Could you expand on that a little bit? I know we can get into that more, but we might as well do that right now.
Might as well do it right now.
Sure.
Go ahead.
As some may or may not know, Kuyper taught a pretty clear doctrine of presupposed regeneration.
Oh, yes, right.
And both Bavinck and Kuyper were instrumental in effecting a union of the two separate churches. Bavinck was in a church that was either called the Separist or the separated churches. The Dutch word is Afgescheiden. They in 1834 they moved out of the old state church, which was illegal at the time. Kuyper's movement stayed within the state church, the Hervormdekerk, and in 1880, they formed kind of a movement within the state church known as the Doliansi. And those two churches were so close together that Bavinck and Kuyper eventually got them together in 1892. And as things began to progress in that, Kuyper at times, as great as he was he had a tendency to take some flights of speculation at times. And one of them was precisely on this point. So the interesting part of the title of Bobbing's book, Calling and Regeneration, is that he argues in that, and this really is just a compilation of articles that he wrote in a church periodical. But what happened there was Bobbing just reversed Kuyper's procedure, and he said, in Kuyper's theology, it's regeneration and then calling, because the infant is presupposed to be regenerate as they come into the covenant community.
Hmm.
Interesting.
That is.
Now, that has an introduction by Mark Beach, is that correct?
That one, I've only got the Dutch. I don't have the English.
Oh, okay.
I think you guys get all these free books.
Well, what can I say? All right, moving on. There's a new book by Donald MacLeod on Scottish theology. And then here's one I was not aware of until just a few moments ago. Ligon Duncan has a book called Moses' Law for Modern Government. That would be interesting.
Really?
Yeah, no, I don't think he's a theonomist, so...
No, Lig isn't. I know that, but it should be a very, very interesting volume.
Sorry, Lig, you can beat me up later. I know you're not a theonomist, but that ought to be interesting.
Have you seen this new one from John Piper and Justin Taylor? Stand, A Call for the Endurance of the Saints.
Oh no, I saw the picture. Yes, I did not. I'm not aware of the. The details of the book.
Neither am I.
Picture, you saw the movie? Is that what you're saying?
And then there is The Sovereignty of God's Mercy by Phil Ryken. The Westminster Assembly, A Guide to Basic Bibliography by David Hall and Ligon Duncan. That's nice. And let's see. We already talked about The Advent of Evangelicalism, I think. That was already dealt with last week or the week before. Let's see. Jesus and the Feminists by Margaret Elizabeth Kestenberger. I believe that could be Andreas Kestenberger's wife. Although I'm not sure about that. Let's see. Anything else?
If you're wrong, they might cause some home problems there.
Oh, well. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. You know, that's just a guess, folks. Let's see. John Calvin, A Heart for Devotion, Doctrine, and Doxology by Burke Parsons. Burke is a colleague of R.C. Sproul, connected with the Ligonier Ministries.
Yeah.
Or with his church, right? I think.
That's right.
And we've already talked about the first volume of Richard Gamble's The Whole Counsel of God. That's almost 900 pages, that volume. And then Stephen Lawson, who's been writing several books for Reformation Trust, is coming out with a book on some guy named Jonathan Edwards called The Unwavering Resolve of Jonathan Edwards. It's part of that series of books, Foundations for Grace, or of Grace, I think, is the series Dr. Lawson has been writing on. And if you want to learn a little bit about the Dr. Lawson himself, that book, Young, Restless, Reformed, has a section on him, and it's very fascinating. He is, I believe, he's a Calvinist within the Southern Baptist denomination, and there's some interesting discussion of his ministry and experience being a Calvinist within that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's all I've got.
Lane, did you see anything?
Yeah, I've been watching the Expositor's Bible Commentary, which is turning out a book every week, just about. I've been dipping into the Proverbs through Isaiah volume. The Isaiah commentary is written by Jeffrey Grogan, and I really enjoyed that commentary. It's a gem, especially his comments on chapter 19. But he accepts full Isaianic authorship of the whole book, which is kind of a rarity, although becoming more common in Isaiah studies. And so I've really appreciated that. And they've also recently published the Romans through Galatians volume. And I do know that Daniel through the Minor Prophets is also scheduled to come out soon. But so that means they've got about, I think, 7 or 8. It's a projected 13-volume series. And they're all either revisions of the earlier Expositor's Bible Commentary, or they're new commentaries written afresh.
Mm-hmm.
So I know, for instance, D.A. Carson is revising his Matthew commentary. I know that Van Gemeren on the Psalms is being revised by Van Gemeren. So a lot of these will simply be updated, better, you know, more modern bibliography, taking into account more recent scholarship. So I'm picking up the volumes as they come out, and really think that they're by some really top quality scholars. So I recommend it.
Lane, can you give us an assessment, say, comparing it to the original edition that was edited by Frank Gebelein?
Yeah, I think, well, like I said, you know, a lot of them, I think they said about a third of the commentaries are by the original authors, and they're going to be revised.
Okay. Right.
I think about two-thirds of them will be new commentaries. And, of course, you've got Trevor Longman and David Garland are the new editors. And they're I think they're doing a pretty good job. It's still based on the New International Version, and the complete text is printed in there. The format's a little different. They have commentary and then followed by just a few technical notes. I believe that's a little different than the original format. And they're pretty substantial commentaries. They're giving Psalms its own volume. And so the original was 12 volumes of commentary and one volume of introductory materials, I think.
Right.
And this, there's no volume of introductory materials. It's 13 volumes of commentary. And I think the result is that they've got a little bit more space to work with. And, I mean, Van Gemeren's commentary was over 800 pages, even in the old edition. So, I think it's looking to be a very good sort of backbone kind of commentary. You know, right. If pastors can't afford a whole lot of commentaries, but they want something on the whole Bible, this would be one good place to go among several options. But this would certainly be a good one that would be up to date. So,
right. I noticed, Lane, you're commenting on Ben Witherington's commentaries and a calling attention of our friends at the Westminster Bookstore that they did not have the Acts of the Apostles commentary.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have that commentary?
I do have that commentary, yes.
Okay. What do you think of his work as a whole? Do you have any comments?
Well, I think Ben Witherington, he does have some Arminian slants, but he's certainly not obnoxiously Arminian.
Right.
He tends to focus on the social and rhetorical. I mean, that's what most of his commentaries are called, except right. His Matthew commentary, which is in the Smith and Helwys series. And I think then his commentaries tend to work best with more historical books like Acts, where the social context becomes extremely important for understanding. I think that sometimes he overemphasizes the aspects of wisdom. For instance, he's got a book called Jesus the Sage.
Yes, he does.
And in Matthew and in John, for instance, I think Ben tends to overemphasize the theme of wisdom. I know this is a criticism D.A. Carson has of Witherington as well, that he makes everything fit a wisdom paradigm where Jesus is this sage and everything he says revolves around the concept of wisdom. Of course, we want to say Jesus has become for us wisdom, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1, but no, that's not all he is, of course.
Right.
So, but I think in Acts, that's probably his best commentary, his best work.
Right. I was going to say his Romans commentary probably is one where his Wesleyanism is most apparent because he's trying to distance himself or distance the book of Romans from the Augustinian tradition. He says that explicitly. I've been reading Witherington since I was a Wesleyan, so my perspective on his commentating, of course, has changed when I became Reformed. But I've always found him useful, a very interesting writer, who, by the way, also has a book on Paul's narrative thought world. He's one of those guys that the news often turns to. The networks often turn to when they want an evangelical commentator.
Yeah, he's on retainer with some of those.
Yes, he is. So, anyways, that's a guy worth reading, even when we disagree.
He's a good scholar, I think.
Yes.
We also wanted to reiterate that Reforming or Conforming will be coming out shortly. Is it just a few weeks, I believe?
The 30th of September.
Yeah, it's probably. I actually thought it would be out by now.
Yeah. Now,
but
do you want to...
a week or two. Go ahead.
Great. Yeah, we've been speaking about that quite a bit. We're really excited about that. I know I've been saying that over and over, but it's true. Several people that we've spoken to have either contributed to that or have edited it. We spoke with Martin Downs. We also spoke with Gary Johnson. We're pleased to have you on now, Ron. But we also wanted just to give you opportunity maybe to tell us why you decided to co-edit this book, maybe the challenges that this book's trying to address, and some of the high points that you found in editing this.
Thanks. I think that one of the greatest challenges that the modern church is facing right now is the emergent constituency. I understand where they're coming from. They got fed up with the megachurch movement. The problem was when they launched out, because they are the children, by and large, of the megachurch movement, they had no spiritual legacy. The parents passed little or nothing along to them except a 5, 10, 12-step program on how to be successful in life. and how to sing praise songs. And so as the net result, and I think combined with the proliferation of postmodernism, has just added to the problem. And I see this happening. I see the influences, not only in what is called, I guess, mainline evangelicalism, but also within certain Presbyterian and Reformed churches as well. And so when Gary and I began talking about this and praying about the book, I was delighted to be able to have a hand in it, because I thought it was very, very worthwhile. At the time, there were a number of books that were already out. I think D.A. Carson's book had done just yeoman's work in introducing the emergent church to the general public. But there were, the movement moved on, there were more and more nuances that needed to be put into place. So that's what we had attempted to do. We tried to make it, on one hand, we tried to make it somewhat scholarly, and on the other hand, we tried to make it very accessible to somebody who just wants to pick it up and find out, okay, I hear about the emergent church, I don't know all that much about it, what can I learn from this volume?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's several excellent chapters in there. We spoke with Martin Downs about his.
Right.
Jeff, you have yours on Van Til and foundationalism.
Right.
There's several really good ones in there. And it is interesting to see, you know, something that's been updated after a few years. Carson's book's much more at a popular level, I think, but it was still,
right,
for me, very helpful in just introducing me to the playing field and telling me what's out there. And then yours to follow up a few years later really starts to hit really hard at some different areas that need to be addressed.
Well, we actually, up until to the 11th hour, we just did, just before the book went to print, we did a major rewrite on the intro, and that was primarily because good old Birkenstock Bry had come out with his book, Everything Must Change, which in some sense you have to believe is a kind of an attempt at ethics from an emergent position. And when you begin to look at it, compare it, say, with something like Jim Wallace's God's Politics, then you see that both of these men are firmly ensconced in the left-wing political machinery. And even though they may tell us that they're trying to be neutral in all of this and that they're trying to be like Fox News, be fair and balanced, they end up really being very tendentious in all that they say. And it's very clear that I find, not only on my blog, but also in reading their literature, that these people today are more concerned about global warming and poverty, and they say that, than they are abortion. They'll say, well, abortion is important, of course, and we want to keep it somehow in the forefront. But more important than that are these global issues, like global warming, which is, as the Germans say, Frostwirtschaft anyway, and then you've got the other position of poverty, the war on poverty, not only nationally but internationally as well. So I think that with McLaren making statements like he's making in this book, Everything Must Change, that was something, when I talked with Gary, we both agreed that we needed to do a major rewrite on the intro on this thing.
Just to bridge the gap, maybe to Bavinck, and maybe even Kuiper and the Dutch guys. Do you have any insights, maybe, of what the Dutch Church, of that era, would have had to say to a theology such as the emergent church?
I do. As a matter of fact, that's what my chapter in the book is about.
There you go.
There was. Let me just get a plug in before on Bavinck. You guys were talking about all these great books, and I was listening very, very closely. Ben Witherington was a couple of years behind me at Gordon when I was there. But a guy named Eric Bristley just come out with the book that Reformation Heritage has published. It's called A Guide to the Writings of Herman Bavinck.
Mm-hmm.
And he has what he's done is, in the one of the first writers on Bavinck doing a dissertation was a man named R.H. Brimmer, who did a book called Bavinck als Dogmaticus, Bavinck as a Dogmatician. And in that, he had just this incredible, incredible bibliography. And he was followed up by one of the people I studied with in the Netherlands, whose name was Jan Veenhoff, who was the successor of Berkauer at the Free University. And he did a book called Revelatie en Inspiratie, Revelation and Inspiration. That thing was about 900 and change pages. And he then increased on the bibliography. And so what Eric has done in this book is that he has gone, he's looked at a lot of the new research. There's been a great deal in terms of international languages. English is not the only language into which the Reform dogmatics have been translated. So there's, I think there's Japanese and Chinese and a whole bunch of other languages. So he's done a great deal of work on that. So for someone who really wants to start delving into bobbing, this is a great new book. And it just, I mean, just literally just came out this week.
Yeah, I think we mentioned that last week. That's really, really interesting title.
And we noted that if it was at least half as good as the bibliography did for Van Til, that that's a phenomenal piece.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Eric also did a THM, I think, comparing and contrasting the apologetics of old Princeton and old Amsterdam.
That sounds right.
Which was a phenomenal piece. I remember telling him when I first read it, I called him. I made an effort to hunt him down, find out where he was. And I said, well, this should have been a PhD. And he said, gee, thanks for telling me now. But he really knows his stuff, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. So, I'm looking forward to meeting him personally next week. We're going to be at an international bobbing symposium at Grand Rapids at Calvin College.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's coming up.
Yeah, Dick Gaffin's going to be there, and I'm going to respond to his paper, and I'm hoping we'll get a book out of this symposium as well.
That'll be good. Very nice.
Well, you are working on, you've just mentioned to us that you've just finished your first edit on a biography for Herman Bovink.
I am.
Could you just tell us a little bit about who he is and why he's such a massive figure in the world of Reformed theology?
I'd be glad to. I mean, that would be an honor to do this. This man is, as far as I'm concerned, probably the greatest theologian that Holland ever produced. He was balanced. He was rock solid. He was thoroughly reformed. He did understand the other theologies very, very well. He was a man of the mid-19th century. He was born in 1854. His father was actually a German, and had lived in the little village of Bentheim, which was just across the border from the Dutch town of Enschede. And Bentheim was a really unusual village in the sense that both German and Dutch were spoken in the village. Church services were all in Dutch. And Bovink's father, Jan Bovink, was the youngest of six, and his father died suddenly at the age of 42, leaving his wife with these children, and Jan Bovink wanted to become a pastor, and eventually, by a whole series of very, very providential events, he did. One of them was that they needed one, the Dutch thought they needed one new pastor. These guys are working their pastors to death, and they decided they had one pastor that they needed, but there were four candidates. And eventually they voted it down to two candidates. Jan Bovink was one of them. And so they cast votes at this classis meeting, and the votes were 11 to 11. So they called the young girl who was in the kitchen, and they decided to settle it by casting lots. They put two names in the hat. She drew Jan Bovink's name. So he goes to the small seminary, which was he was the only student, so he had to prepare well because chances of getting called on were pretty good. And he goes there, and as soon as he finishes and finally graduates, there's a war, and Bentheim calls him into service. So he goes and he's taking his physical outside, and he's in this long line, and the guy in front of him takes his physical. Bovink steps up, and the doctor looks at him and says to him in German, "We have enough men. We don't need you anymore. You're free to go." So he was the next guy in line. So he goes. He marries a Dutch woman. They move to the Netherlands, and this guy was just amazing in the sense that he was pious in the very good sense of the word. And at the same time, he was very, very sound, very, very good teacher, educator. And he taught Herman a lot of the things that Herman really needed in life. And his mother then, who was a resolute Dutch woman, was the other force to be reckoned with in his life. So as Bovink came along, I mean, he cut against the grain because when he was born in 1854, the separated churches that I talked about earlier had just formed their own seminary in the little village of Kampen in the province of Overijssel. And Jan Bovink was named as one of the teachers and he couldn't decide whether he should do this or not. And so he had decided that, well, Providence has intervened in my life before. He wrote two letters, an acceptance letter and a letter of rejection, put them in an envelope, sealed them up, called a student to come up to his study, choose one of the letters, and throw it in the mailbox. And the student chose the rejection. Yeah, I know. So, but anyway, what happened was, they eventually, Jan Bobbing went to Compton, where he was the pastor there for more than 40 years, and Herman was there with him. But Herman decided with this school that it just really wasn't quite what he wanted, and so instead of going to this conservative school, he chose to go to Leiden, which was where Kuyper had gone several years before. But at Leiden, it was just a very well-known liberal school. There were three state universities in the Netherlands, Leiden, Utrecht, and then up in Groningen. And all three of these were just awful. They were the ones that were training the pastors that came into the state church. And so you could be a Buddhist, you could be an atheist, you could be, you know, anything you wanted to be. And you could still be a pastor in the state church. So, as long story short, Herman began his studies there. He learned well. He was just an amazing scholar. I mean, he wrote his doctoral dissertation on the idea of the state and the theology of Zwingli. Mm-hmm. He was an amazing Old Testament scholar.
Really?
He had a man that was a good friend of him whose name was Snook Kunkuroya, and the two of them worked through the Old Testament in Hebrew at least twice in his lifetime. Yeah. I mean, they just went right through that thing. He was when he began to be offered teaching positions at the Free University in particular, they offered him everything. He was great at New Testament. He was great at Old Testament. He was good at the history of doctrine. He was great in systematic theology. And eventually, I think that whole composite of Bobbing's life reflects itself in the Reformed dogmatics. I was talking to a colleague out here just the other day, and he was saying he had started reading it, and he said, it's just like a feast. It's just a feast. You get everything you need. You get the Hebrew, you get the Greek, you get the history of the doctrine, and you get the systematic theology that's truly Reformed. So Bobbing truly stood head and shoulders above everyone, including Kuyper. I mean, obviously, Kuyper is the better known of the two. Kuyper ran as premier of the country on a Christian ticket and won. He only served one term, but he won. And at the same time, I think it should be pointed out, to Bobbing's credit, that during Kuyper's tenure, Bobbing served as what we would consider to be today a senator, while he was the professor of dogmatics at the Free University when he finally went over in 1902. He's just a fascinating man. The same group, John Bolton and John Friend and those guys, have come out with some of his collected writings now. The occasional writings, his speeches, and what I'm doing in the biography is taking some of his important speeches, his acceptance speech when he first went to Compton, his acceptance speech at the Free University, some talks that he gave. 1888, he gave a wonderful talk on the Catholicity of the Church. And this was just prior, obviously, to this union in 1892, so he was trying to make some on that as well. But he was just a man who was so balanced. He did not have, as I mentioned earlier, the speculative part of him that Kuyper had. And I'm not trying to diss on Kuyper, because obviously he was a great theologian, and we're truly indebted to him. I don't think there's any book better, really, on life and worldview than his lectures on Calvinism, unless it would be Bobbing's lectures that he gave, Stone Lectures, in 1909. At the end of that book, he had... his talk is on Revelation and what that is. And in the back of that book, and that has been translated. You can probably get one secondhand, and they're probably going to re-release it. But he has a very, very interesting section on Christian life and worldview. And then he has some smaller books that are probably about 100 pages or so, where he has just honed in particularly on Christian life and worldview, but they're all in Dutch still.
I was wondering if you could comment a little bit. I was just reading fairly recently the letters of Gerhardus Voss. As you know, they Bovink and Voss corresponded rather a lot. And I was wondering if you could comment on the influence Voss has had introducing Bovink to the United States.
Voss was very instrumental in that. And if you take, you know, James Dennison has just put out the letters of Voss, and there's some correspondence between Voss and Bovink in that book. When Bovink came to Princeton in 1909 to deliver the Stone Lectures, he stayed with the Voss family. And he and Voss kept up a pretty active correspondence with each other. And especially it was interesting in light of the fact that Voss was beginning to develop his biblical theology type of thing. And I've read the letters, read the correspondence, and I put part of that in the biography, I don't think that they were really at loggerheads with each other. That it wasn't that one was claiming systematic theology, for example, at the exclusion of biblical theology, or the other way around. And as a matter of fact, Voss even tried his hand at a systematic theology. For those who are really the bibliophiles, I have part of it in photocopied form, but he wrote a two-volume dogmatique that it was written on a typewriter and still in that form. Nobody has tried to improve upon it, and all the Greek and all the Hebrew is in handwritten form, as we used to have to do it back in the Dark Ages when I was in seminary. And so I think that the relationship between these two men was quite congenial. They got along a lot better than some people think they did.
How would you detail their differences in terms of their eschatologies, for instance?
Their eschatology. I think in terms of eschatology, it's interesting. That's a great question, but because eschatology in Holland has just never been a major issue. As I've read for my New Testament professor, and I had the distinct honor and privilege, Herman Ritterboss had retired about 6 months before I got to the Netherlands, and I went and pled my case with him, and got permission to be his final student. I had private lessons from my Greek and New Testament courses from Ritterboss were taken in his study in his house. And
wow,
that was fun. And he would walk back and forth and lecture with a cigar. And I knew it was a good lecture when halfway through I couldn't see him anymore. He disappeared into the smoke.
And just as a side note, Lane Tipton, one of my professors, was talking similarly about Meredith Klein, and he said you knew it was a good lecture when there was too much chalk dust you couldn't see through Klein's glasses.
Oh, Klein was amazing. He was my faculty advisor at Gordon.
Yeah.
And he was the one. He and Sproul and a couple of others were really instrumental in getting to me to be reformed, because I was a flaming Arminian when I went up to Gordon in 1973. But I remember taking the course Exegesis Daniel with Meredith Klein. I had him for Pentateuch and Exegesis Zechariah. We do an Exegesis Daniel, and one of my classmates, there were only like six of us in the class. Nobody wanted to take him because he was so hard. And this one guy's sitting there, and he's making all of these faces, and Dr. Klein turns around and he says, Milton, is something wrong? He said, well, you know, Dr. Klein, I was just getting ready to ask a question. He said, I don't even know what I want to ask you anymore. He was that kind of guy. By the time he got finished with the board, you had no idea what he had put up
there. Yeah, that's what I hear.
He was fun. Yeah, he was quite a guy. We were hoping against hope to be able to find something. His son, Meredith, who was also one of my Hebrew teachers at Gordon, is the librarian at Gordon Conwell right now, and we were hoping that he was going to be able to find something that Dr. Klein had written to contribute to David Wells' Festschrift that I'm also being honored to co-edit. So we were back to the whole idea of,
right, right.
Of eschatology. Both of those guys would have been solidly Amil. That was not even a question. Everybody just assumed that you were Amil there, because that was considered to be the biblical position to hold.
I might be my bias might be coming out because we oftentimes sometimes use the word I do eschatology in a much broader sense, and I guess maybe what I was more asking was about Voss's views of biblical theology and redemptive history.
In that sense, they would be very, very close again. As a matter of fact, Bobbink has a section in, if you have the fourth volume, you can find it when he begins his discussion on eschatology, where he says, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but basically he says, eschatology is Christology.
Hmm.
That would be very similar to Voss.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course.
My own sense when reading Bobbink was that he was much more redemptive historical than, say, Kuyper. Again, that's just a sense. I don't think I can point to particular passages.
You're exactly correct. Matter of fact, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, and that's the beauty. That's one of the beauties of reading. You know, I have the Dutch version, but it takes me forever to plow through Dutch. And so getting that English, if I may echo Hopkins' comments about Edwards and Locke, getting a hold of Bovink in English was like a miser running his hands full through piles of gold.
Oh, I know. I understand.
I mean, it really was a phenomenal.
So Ron, are you saying that Herman Bobbink would be both an amillennialist and a self-respecting Calvinist?
You can be both.
Yeah, in the same breath and at the same time. Yeah, it really is amazing. And he does have a section in the Reformed Dogmatics where he kind of inveighs against what he calls chiliasm.
Yeah.
But it's fairly brief and more in Holland in general, even among the liberals, that's just not an issue. It wasn't an issue for Ritterboss. The assumption is whenever you go there, at least when I was there, I was in the Netherlands for about 10 years, that if you're Reformed, you're Amil, and you don't smoke pipes because that's for Bardians.
Oh,
cigarettes are for liberals.
Jeff, we got to talk about that.
Ron, I had a question about Bovink, and because you had touched on some subjects that are very near and dear to my heart, near and dear to my thesis, actually.
Here we go.
Talking about general theology and the fact that Bovink was so well educated in all the fields of theology. Could you give us some idea of how Bobbink can teach us that the various branches of theology don't compete with each other, but actually mutually inform one another? And horror of horrors, systematic theology can actually influence exegesis.
Yeah, and often that's a great question, a great point. And often in our, I know when I was at Gordon Conwell, there was this enormous antithesis between the New Testament department in particular that was there then and the systematic theology department. And I would have New Testament professors just ridiculing systematic theology, saying, you know, we're doing the real exegesis here. And all they're doing is just taking our work and trying to construct some kind of house once we get through with our, but with Bobbink, it was just the opposite. I mean, this man, but you know, it's also interesting that when I was studying in the Netherlands, everything you study is just called theology. You have to declare a major and two minors. But other than that, every course you take is considered to be theology. And in that sense, it's supposed to be an integral part of everything that you're doing. So when you're doing your New Testament, you're not doing that with a view to competing with systematic theology. And a classic case in point of that would be both Ritterboss as well as G.C. Birkhauer. Now, I did have the privilege of meeting Birkhauer, and we had a three-hour talk. And he was a very, very genteel man. I think he ended up on the wrong side of the coin on a number of things. But at the same time, when you go back and you read Birkhauer, whether you read him in Dutch or you read him in what English translations are still there, or you read Ritterboss, you will find not only is there exegesis, but those men unashamedly would pull from systematic theology. They would pull unashamedly from the confessional statements. I mean, you read Birkhauer, you read Ritterboss, and they're always talking about the Heidelberg Catechism and the Belgic Confession, not so much about the Westminster Standards, but their three forms of unity, the canons of Dort, all came into play. They would, you could tell that these men were well-read in Old Testament studies as well. And so I think we can take a great lesson from that, from the Netherlands, and from people like Bobbing, who will just simply integrate these things into his theology, including things that are philosophical in nature as well, and not see them necessarily as competing, unless the philosophy, of course, is something that's aberrant. So the main difference that Bobbing would see was philosophy is work from below, and theology is work from above.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's possible, even for today's seminaries, to educate people in an integrated way?
You know, that's a $64,000 question. I think it depends a lot on the seminary. I think it's one of those things where right now my initial response to that is probably no. And I think that's because a number of the professors tend to try to compete with one another at the seminaries. I've, for the longest time, I've kind of held this view that one of the best things we can do is have a kind of a co-op between the pastor and the seminary. I do believe, and it was Lig Duncan, I believe, who said this a couple of years ago at Twin Lakes Fellowship when I was there. He made the comment that scholarship's best place is in the pulpit. And I thought that was a very telling subject, or very telling statement. And I think there's an element of truth to that. I think what happens in theology is that, or in the seminaries, is that people tend to specialize so much that the more you specialize, the more it pulls the disciplines apart rather than integrating them properly. And at the same time, some of the times I've seen, it's really been disheartening to me that there has been some undue competition between the departments, and I don't think that needs to be there. Can it happen? It could, conceivably. Will it? I'm not certain it will, unless there's some major changes.
Right.
Now, I have several questions here from various listeners. We've already addressed a few of them, but I had one here that I would like to get your feedback on. This question says, you know, that it seems to our listener that as they read Bovink, that Bovink rejects both condign and congruent merit in the covenant of works, and he wanted to get your feedback on that.
No, I don't think so. I think the section in the Reformed dogmatics on the covenant of works doesn't lend itself that way to me. It's a fairly short section, to say the least, but nonetheless, I believe that what you find is in Bovink is just the standard acceptance of the doctrine of the covenant of works and the application of that covenant of works eventually to Christ and his active and passive obedience. So when you come to his Christology in particular, you find just a very, very healthy emphasis on the active and the passive obedience of Christ, and you find that again within the context of his sections on his section on justification as well. So, short answer is no. I don't think there's a conflict there.
Is there any interaction with Turretin? Turretin's views on that?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. I'm doing this from home today, so I don't have access to my volumes. But they're typically with Bobbing. You do have some Turretin. You do have some interaction with him on that. But I'm not certain about that particular point.
Okay. Well, thanks. Excellent. You already mentioned his interactions with Kuyper. You've mentioned the somewhat of the shakeup between the two. What about Kuyper's sort of transformational views? What were Bovink's views on that? You also mentioned, I'm kind of curious to see if there's anything about his views coming out of his dissertation on Zwingli and the state?
Yeah.
Is there anything in there that might be counter to Kuyper's own political views, perhaps?
Maybe transformational views with regard to the culture, you mean?
Yeah, that.
Yeah, okay. With Bovink's dissertation was more descriptive than it was creative. So basically all he ended up doing was talking about the way that that Zwingli saw the relationship of the church to the culture with Kuyper. And there's a Dutch ethicist whose name is Joachim Douma, D-O-U-N-A, and some of his stuff has been translated. He has Nelson Klosterman did a book, and Nelson was in Holland when I was. He did his book on ethics called Responsible Conduct. His work on the Ten Commandments is just masterful, really worthwhile having. But within the context of that whole thing, Kuyper had a much better view, or a worse view, rather, of the culture in the sense of accepting it than Bobbink did. And one of the biographers of Bobbink, one of the first biographers, actually, a man named Valentine Hepp, said that in the Bobbink household, the reason that Bobbink had this different view from Kuyper was because Bobbink was a man who found it strange to be in the culture because of his parents' background. I think that's just grossly overstated. Hepp typically did a great job in the biography, but there wasn't that attitude. Bobbink was kind of cautious, and if both Bobbink and Kuyper held to a view of the antithesis vis-a-vis the culture, which they did, Bobbink held to it probably a little bit more stringently than Kuyper did. I mean, Kuyper's there have been dissertations after dissertations after dissertations written on Bobbink's or on Kuyper's view of common grace, and how that was probably less than what Bobbink held. So there were some differences there. However, having said that, I think it's important to note that both of them worked to transform the culture. If you read through Bobbink's occasional writings in particular, you will find him talking constantly about developing a worldview. And he was unashamed to say that what he wanted was the Christian worldview in culture, in all of culture. He wasn't a theonomist in that sense, so he wasn't for the imposition of God's law totally within the culture, but his aim and his desire was to get the culture as Christianized as he possibly could.
Now, in the recent edition of the Westminster Theological Journal, there's an article that's dealing with Van Til and his use of Bobbink, actually his criticisms of Bobbink's apologetics. I really wish I could remember the person's name. Jeff, do you remember?
Brian Mattson.
Yes. So thank you for remembering that for me. Basically, if I got this right, if I recall, his thesis was that Van Til was too hard on Bobbink because Bobbink was his, you know, closest relative in terms of theology, and Van Til was so indebted to him and stood on his shoulders, and that prior to Van Til, nobody really articulated Van Til's apologetic quite the way he did because he was so original, so he shouldn't have been so hard on Bobbink. Do you find that thesis accurate?
I thought no. Short answer is no. I think this must have been the same editor that allowed John Franke's article in there. No, I think stop that. Don't say things like a number of the concepts that are in Bobbink's theology, I find that Van Til just took over just piecemeal.
Yes,
And one of them, of course, was thinking God's thoughts after him. That is one of Bobbink's big things. And I think both Kuyper and Bobbink were presuppositionalists before the name became formalized by... now, obviously, Dr. Van Til took it to a new level. Again, as I mentioned earlier with regard to the doctrines of eschatology, the only other thing that's less important than eschatology in Holland is apologetics. And there just is no such thing. I remember trying, when I was there, trying to talk to people about that, and they would give you a quizzical look, like, not sure what you're talking about here. But Dr. Van Til was able to cull, especially from Bobbink's theology, the whole idea of what we come to know and appreciate as presuppositionalism.
Yeah. I think that's actually what the article was getting at, the fact that Van Til was critical of Bobbink in some areas, but he shouldn't have been because of all theologians, Van Til was the closest to Bobbink and actually used his theology and learned from it.
Without having not seen the article, if that's what he ended up saying, then I would agree with him that Dr. Van Til was really indebted to bombing for many of his contests, probably more so than he realized. I mean, that's one of those things. I was not too terribly long ago, I was talking to somebody, and they said, I made some comment, and they said, did you make that up, or did you think that up yourself, or did you hear it from somebody else?
Yeah.
And I said, at this point, I'm not sure. And I went home that night, and I was reading a section of Bobbing, and there it was. And so I called them up, and I said, no, it wasn't an original thought.
Right.
Got it from Bobbing. Sometimes it's just like that. If you read someone so much, study someone so much, and I think that Van Til was an excellent man who understood Bobbing and his theology quite well.
Mm. Now that we have the Reformed Dogmatics, the four-volume set, and also the fifth volume that kind of goes along with that, the essays and collected writings,
right?
Where is a reasonable faith? Where is that placed, and where would you recommend someone to start reading if they want to get into Bobbing?
That's if you're just getting into Bobbing, then reasonable faith is a great place to start. Our reasonable faith, and I must admit that I'm a little bit at a loss about why we came up with that title. It is in 1909, Bobbing published his popular dogmatics under the name of Magnalia Dei, The Great Things of God. And when Zylstra translated that back in the 70s, that was the title that Baker put on it then, and it's just kind of stuck. But I'm reading this book with my session right now, and they're just absolutely loving it. And so I would say, if you want to start with Bobbing, start with the Our Reasonable Faith. And I would suggest getting it from the Westminster Bookstore, because any place else is going to cost you an arm and a leg. And then after that, the next thing I would suggest is to buy several hundred thousand copies of my biography, and that'll give you a shameless ad there.
You can get right on that. We'll send the...
But I do, I mean, all seriousness with the biography, I feel like that I know Bobbing as well, if not better, than any other American. And that, having lived in Holland for 10 years and all the rest, and done the research while I was there, gone to the archives and everything else, I think there are going to be a lot of things in the biography that will help you understand why the man wrote what he wrote in the Reformed Dogmatics, as well as his occasional writings. I'm hoping that John Bolt is going to come out with another volume, because there's another volume that's called Knowledge and Life. It's a translated title.
Oh, yeah. Tennyson Latham.
Yeah, it's got some wonderful, wonderful, wonderful articles in there. As a matter of fact, I did part of my thesis contained Bobbing's appreciation of John Calvin's view of the Lord's Supper. That was the only chapter and only section in all of the Reformed Dogmatics that he never changed, was the section on the Lord's Supper. He wrote it in the first edition, and he never changed it after that. He changed a lot of other things, but he'd never changed that.
Now, we mentioned the emerging church, but as we are about out of time here, having steeped yourself in Bobbing, what would you think Bobbing would want us now, at this point in redemptive history, at this point, given all the challenges the church is dealing with here in the beginning of the 21st century, what do you think Bobbing would most want us to hear and to learn and take from his writings?
Well, in terms of the emergent church, he would want it to because we mentioned early on in the interview that there was a group, and that's in my article, my chapter in the Reforming and Conforming, called the Emergent Theologians. I'm sorry, the Ethical Theologians. And the Ethical Theologians were, I mean, it's eerie how almost identical they were. I mean, obviously they had kind of a much more of a reform background than the emergent tribe does. But in terms of the way that they began to spin out their reform theology, it began with the church. And it moved from there. The church would then test revelation. And pretty much what you see within the emergent conversation at this point is that they're doing the same thing. The church is deciding what's going to stay, what's going to go, or some of their non-leaders are going to want to stay. My idea of Bobbing was, in addition to being a dogmatician, Bobbing was a pastor, he was a churchman, and he was a politician. And as all of those, what he wanted more than anything else was for the people of God to stay by the Word of God. And I know that some people today, like Peter Enns and other people, even Andrew McGowan, have suggested that Bobbink's view of the human in the writing of the scriptures leaves us with less than a infallible Bible. I don't think that's true for a minute. I think Bobbink would want us to go back, do our research, take the new things that are coming along, incorporate them, but always hold the Holy Scriptures in very, very high esteem. And that was what preachers ought to preach. You go back, we only have a few of his sermons, but you go back and you read those sermons, and that's what they were all about.
Mm. And we just want to, as we get going, to mention everyone, you can pick up Reforming or Conforming coming up at the end of the month. That's from Presbyterian and Reformed Publishers.
Oh, it's Crossway.
Oh, sorry.
The biographies from Presbyterian.
That's my next question. And do you have any estimate at when that's going to hit the shelf?
As fast as my little fingers can work, it's probably going to be middle of 2009.
Okay. That's good. That's good. We're excited to see that.
Right now, it's going to be about a 400-plus page biography.
Wow.
Well, we're about out of time. I hate to cut us short because this has been such a great discussion, but we'll have to continue this some other time and expand on some of these themes. And of course, we'll be back next week, but until then, you can visit castlechurch.org to read our show notes. You can also get today's bibliography. You can visit our forums and interact with us and other listeners there at forums.castlechurch.org. At the website, you can also find more information about our other programs. You can subscribe to our podcast feeds in order to get this program and some others that are forthcoming automatically downloaded to your computer. If you have a book review you would like to contribute to our new audio program that's going to center around book reviews and other media reviews, please send that to us. Visit the contact page on the website and send us a note, and we'll get in touch with you about putting that into our new show. We'd like to thank you for listening, and we look forward to having you back next time on Christ the Center.